hour. So we just wanted to, okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Whether you're home at Zoom or wherever you're Zooming, or you are at the United Lodge, Theosophy Hall, 1917 Walnut Street, you are welcome. This is the only meeting that is both live and on Zoom. The Wednesday and Friday meetings are continuing on Zoom. So we just want to mention for those who come to the lodge that make an effort to maintain a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those with sensitivities. So during the pandemic, it has been a comforting and joyful experience to Zoom to a meeting. It is important to recall the ULT Declaration, which will be read momentarily. Philadelphia ULT meetings maintain anonymity, offer no crosstalk or side issues of personal anecdotes. Participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These are traditions that are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy of theosophy without distinctions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Let us all work to maintain these declared traditions. So we're going to mention that, today we have a talk, it's a panel, and it's on subduing the wandering heart. So Theosophy Hall opens at 10:30 on Sunday mornings. The meeting begins at 11 and ends promptly at 12. This month, the overall umbrella topic is the path of spiritual evolution. And there are five Sundays this month, so we get a little extra in that respect as far as that topic goes. So on Wednesday evenings, we're studying what is it, chapter 8? I think it's the first half of chapter 8 on reincarnation. And that meeting is from 7:30 to 8:45. And on Friday, we're beginning the 16th installment of Echoes of the Orient, which is a series of articles that was written for the general public, but there's a lot of, there's quite a lot in there, and it's always very interesting, usually just two or three pages. So it's a less formal roundtable discussion, and that begins at 6:30 and ends at 7:30. Now, all of our efforts at the lodge are due to voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. And all are certainly welcome, but nothing is imposed or even implied. It's all due to one's free will and seeing the need. So, the declaration. The policy, excuse me. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So we'll have two short talks followed by Q&A, discussion, comments, observations. And the wandering heart. What is subduing the wandering heart? Well, that's a curious sounding title in a way. We think about subduing the mind and getting that under control. But what about the heart? Well, the desires really arise in the heart, don't they? Before we're even aware of them in our mind, there's something that moves us. It's said, behind will stands desire. So we do talk a lot about one's heart's desire. It's almost like a lifetime meditation. Like the teacher asked the little boys and girls, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And often they don't know, or they pick something that's very mundane that they're familiar with, or maybe something very lofty, something that's very, like an astronaut or something like that, or president of the United States. And that's also a common answer too. But we bring this vast storehouse of knowledge with us. And if it's nurtured in the child, if the child gets the proper support and the proper encouragement, then often these past memories can come forth. And so one can begin to work on one's heart's desire. So we just want to start out with a short quote. It says, saith the pupil, O teacher, what shall I do to reach wisdom? A wise one, what to gain perfection? Search for the paths, O Lanu, be of clean heart before thou startest on thy journey, before thou takest thy first step. Learn to discern the real from the false, the ever-fleeting from the everlasting. Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the eye from the heart doctrine. So the voice of the silence is, is something that is all students of theosophy are encouraged to study and to meditate on and to think about and to try to incorporate this wisdom, the soul wisdom in one's life. And We need search, study, reflection, and practice. They are the four ways needed to reach this wisdom. So we have to search, in a sense, for the path. Study, reflection, practice. It's really very simple when one thinks about it. It's not complicated. And we need the head. We need the head doctrine because we need to learn our ABCs of occultism, as it were. And really, the heart doctrine is another way of saying occultism. It's those underlying laws of nature that may not be apparent. And they're not apparent if we're too caught up in the hurly-burly, mundane day, making a living, providing for the family, all those things that are very necessary. But we need to leave time for study and reflection as well. So the head doctrine or intellect is the ability to reason from premises to conclusion. Theosophy is self-knowledge, and intellect will only take us part way. So the head doctrine is a means, but not an end. It's definitely, we can't skip it. We can't even, we can't just try to float off into the into other worlds untethered by the knowledge that we need to learn, which is the head doctrine. Intellect is generally, but we also must remember that intellect is generally in bondage to sense and matter. So the heart doctrine, it also includes the head doctrine. So for those seeking to understand the material world, head learning, which is gained via the senses and the brain and the intellect. So with discipline, the intellect may use the methods of reasoning, logic, or scientific methods to develop more objective and universally valid knowledge. So it's said even that the adepts, that they test, check, and verify through eons of time, that the knowledge on which theosophy is based, which comes through the masters of wisdom, the elder brothers, which they vouchsafe for us. During prior periods of evolution, they were, as we are now, the same struggles, the same cares and worries, but they have transcended that, and they have made the conscious decision to stay behind and work with struggling humanity. And that is a choice that we will eventually make in the distant future. So it's necessary to use the intellect to search for wisdom, but the effort must open up and use the higher mind. And we need this in order to think through the archetypal concepts, principles, and correspondences. And that's how we learn, through analogy and correspondence. So it really is, a lot of it is headwork. It's work. It's unity work and study. And study, of course, is something that is very much encouraged in theosophy. So in the Key to Theosophy, HPB offers she offers several methods of education that produce, that promote both head learning and heart qualities. True theosophical education must treat the child as an intelligent individual. Each child must be taught how to think and reason for himself. He must also be taught mutual charity, love for fellow man, and above all, unselfishness. And the unselfish part is, of course, the heart doctrine. And also, in the key, it says that purely mechanical workings of memory should be reduced to a minimum. Necessary, but rote learning should not be the main point. Just studying for an exam and then forgetting afterwards, which a lot of education unfortunately is. Knowledge of the soul, that is really what we need. And that's going to be brought out in the second talk, which will be mostly on the heart. So we'll have the second speaker at this time.
So we'll start out with, if people have a book of quotations, like little meditations from Mr. Judge and Mr. Crosby, both of them for today's readings are very appropriate to our panel discussion today. And Mr. Crosby says, each day contains no more than a day's work. Each day contains so many hours for that appointed work. Let each day and hour be attended to as it arrives. Avoid useless sacrifice of thought and effort. Conserve energies. Work without strain. So he's basically talking about here how we can subdue this wandering heart. And then Mr. Judge says, we are tried in wondrous ways, and in the seemingly unimportant affairs of life, there often lie the most dangerous of temptations. And again, he also comments about how we can subdue the wandering heart. And we've just heard a comparison of the eye and the heart doctrines. And is there a reason why we really need to know about these doctrines? And practically, how can any of this knowledge do anything to help us with the strife that was mentioned in the first talk? How do we put this into practice? This month's umbrella topic is the path of spiritual evolution. And today's panel will concentrate on how the eye and the heart doctrine can assist us along that evolutionary path. Last Sunday's class focused on the greatest lawful war, which is the battle between the higher and the lower aspects of mind. We were also presented the seven principles of man. And where does this heart doctrine, where does this idea fit into it? With that lawful war, it was a war between the higher and the lower. And again, we're looking at a war between the eye and the heart doctrine. Although it has been shown that in many cases, we do need the basis of the eye doctrine that is being given to us. B.P. Wadia has a wonderful very short but very full pamphlet called the Studies in the Voice of the Silence. And he says, the control of the wandering mind is a necessity universally recognized, but how many think of the wandering heart? When the heart has been steadied, which is what this class is going to look at today, concentration of mind becomes easy, for then an objective has been found. And of course, the heart that we're looking at today is not that physical heart, but we're looking at how do we look at the idea of a spiritual heart. The spiritual heart is focused on compassion, which is the law of laws. The higher somebody is along their spiritual journey, along their evolution, the more compassionate they will be. And we know that the elder brothers are compassionate incarnate. The wandering heart does not focus totally on the higher spiritual nature, but it vacillates between the heart and the I doctrines. So, the wandering heart, how do we subdue it then? And this idea of wandering is it gives the impression of going back and forth from one thing to another. Like if we can't make a decision on something, we keep going back, oh, well, I'll do this. No, wait, this sounds better. And we go back and forth. And it's moving aimlessly. So that's basically what this wandering heart is. It's going back and forth from the I to the heart. Our goal then is to keep focused on the heart aspect, but how do we do that? So the philosophy gives us some ideas, and these are only a few, and the rest can certainly come up during discussion today. We can look at the ideas of renunciation versus liberation. We can look at the idea of duty and motive and knowledge. So there are the ideas that are mentioned in both the Gita and the Voice regarding liberation and renunciation. This is also applicable to the idea of the wandering heart. And when we're looking at liberation, it sounds like it should be something good. But liberation is when the soul has reached the point of where they can go to nirvana. They are being liberated from the distress of their younger brothers of the world. And it's almost like a rest period, but they will be responsible for deserting their younger brothers in future incarnations. But with the idea of renunciation, the soul is renouncing the entrance into nirvana because it is being drawn back to help their younger brothers. So when we look at this idea of how do we subdue the wandering heart, the focus should be on this idea of renunciation. Because we have these choices that we can make along the way, whether to renounce or to go or to liberate ourselves. And so it's a higher union by renouncing. We can help others instead of taking this rest in nirvana. It is known as the path of woe, renouncing, because that soul is being pulled back into the hardships of the world. That soul is making a commitment of service to others. And this is an initial step towards subduing the wandering heart. Many times, so we do need to go to develop this heart quality. And the question for today is, how do we do that? Many times, the soul is fortunate enough to have been born into a very caring, compassionate family, and it learns this from birth. But not all souls are fortunate enough to do that, to be in an enlightened family. And then some people along their way, it's like an aha moment that they get, that realizing that this is not the way life should be. And then they start on the way of trying to raise up their mind to a higher level, being able to access the higher self to get those compassionate ideas and work with them. So in order to focus on renunciation, which is essential to subduing the heart, these ideas of duty, and the Bhagavad Gita talks significantly about duty. And when we do our duty, we don't expect anything in return. What comes to us has been given to us opportunities from choices we have made in the past. So by accepting these duties and doing what has to be done, that is another path towards subduing the wandering heart, because we are focusing on our higher nature. And that higher nature is, we have to look at the idea of motive made with right knowledge. And actions must be done in response to right knowledge, which impacts right motive. Because doing something with the wrong idea of how to do it sometimes can cause more problems than if nothing was done. So we're looking at a balance then between right knowledge and motive and subduing the heart, the wandering heart, as well as, you know, liberation and renunciation. And, you know, the heart doctrine and the eye doctrine, everything is a balance. We need, as was said, we need to use the eye doctrine for information and for this knowledge, but the knowledge has to be tempered with compassion. To add to all this is the knowledge, and this is one of the main points, that we must all understand that we are spiritual beings. To attain the knowledge of the soul is one of the ways that we can subdue the wandering heart. And we're all at different levels of enlightenment, aren't we? Some may seem much more compassionate than others. And others keep that compassion inward. They may not be a very showy person, but when things need to be done in a compassionate manner, they're there. They're the first one to volunteer. And by understanding, we are given the knowledge that we can become focused on our higher nature and that all consciousness can be raised up. It is the human race that is responsible for raising up all the lower kingdoms, and the knowledge of this is another aspect to subduing the wandering heart. By doing all of this, we purify our lower nature. This will allow the divine intuitions of our higher minds to filter through and subdue our wandering hearts. And we just want to end with, from the voice of the silence, hast thou attuned thy heart and mind to the great mind and heart of all mankind? For as the sacred river's roaring voice, whereby all nature sounds are echoed back, so must the heart of him who in the stream would enter thrill in response to every sigh and thought of all that lives and breathes. So we'll take questions and comments now.
Asel?
It would seem that to subdue the wandering heart, to concentrate it, we have to arouse in us the spiritual will in order to subdue the heart. So what is the process there? How do we use this principle of the heart or desire to arouse the will so that our desires become more focused?
Well, the part of it is, I mean, we do have, you know, a lot of the books that we can read, The Voice of the Silence, the Bhagavad Gita, even like these little meditation books are very helpful. But practically, knowing that we are spiritual beings, that everyone is a spiritual being, no matter at what level of evolution they are, and they all deserve compassionate attention. You know, the homeless on the street, the person who is the our server in a restaurant, everybody deserves to be treated compassionately and caringly. And by becoming aware that this is what our duty is. When we talk about a lifetime's meditation, it is compassion. It's the caring that we give. And our will is like the impetus behind that. We have to look at life in a different manner.
So will is a universal principle that pervades everyone, every sentient being in the universe. But to subdue it, or to channel it, we should say maybe, into more constructive means, we need to look at, are we being separative? Are we being concerned only with getting what I want, when I want, when I want it, like many children are, and many adults are too? They never outgrow that. I want what I want, when I want it. So, and we need to separate wants from needs. Often when one gets what one desires, if it's a lower nature and a materialistic nature, it's when one gets it, they realize how empty it is, how it's really not, it doesn't make me happy. It doesn't satisfy me. This new luxury car, it's fine for a little while, but it's like, is that all there is? So the eye and the heart doctrine combine, it's a method and a means for subduing the animal man and raising up to become a fully human man. And ultimately, realizing our own divinity, that we are divine. We are divine beings. So we can look at the whole, everything universally, and realize that we should always be acting for the good of all concerned and not our own separative wants that are based in our five senses.
JCS, you had your hand up.
Well, the puzzle is with the examples given, the thinking remains on the sentimental level of desire. Being kind in the moment to a stranger can still mask a degree of separatism, can't it? So while we're trying to live right and do no harm, isn't there a companion piece of meditation that needs to go with these outward signs of kindness and sentimental compassion?
Well, we should always be meditating on kindness and compassion, but we need to act in the moment. So we may feel good giving someone a coffee or buying them lunch or giving them a coat, and but we shouldn't feel self-satisfied that, look how wonderful I am. Or we shouldn't tell anyone about it either, really. It should just be done because it's there to be done. So, comments?
Yeah, we wonder about that term that has been used in the meeting so far, lifetimes meditation, because that type of a meditation is that we are looking, we are bringing the mundane, we are raising that mundane to a higher spiritual level. And it can become, and you know, if we continuously look at the spiritual nature, if it's possible to continuously look at the spiritual nature of everything, and that our duty will come to us if we are open to the awareness of it.
And as far as charity goes, HPB in the key goes into the fact that many of the rich, they play at charity, and because it's a show. So it should never be showy. It should be done humbly and without any kind of judgment as to that person. MDW has a hand up.
Isn't the reality that the heart is selfless? It is love absolute. It is compassion. And what creates the war, isn't it our minds, our separateness, our selfishness? You know, that if we were of a compassionate mind and an intelligent heart, let that be our guide. You know, we can study as much as we want, but if we do not have that love of humanity, that love for each other, it always ends up badly for us, because we all are in conflict, because our heart wants us to do one thing, but our mind usually points us in another direction.
Well, we hope it doesn't usually point us in another direction. Occasionally, perhaps, but you know, if we're studying about compassion and love and caring all the time, and then we're usually not acting that way, there's something wrong there, we think.
No, it's that. We can look at the idea of last week's class about a lawful war. Although it's not, you know, we don't want it to be lawful, but that is the war. That's what's in the Bhagavad Gita. The whole thing is about, you know, the higher and the lower. That there's this battle that goes on. And this is what we talk about with subduing that wandering heart, is we keep vacillating, going back and forth, back and forth. And to concentrate on the compassion and the love that was just mentioned. What's that one saying about act as if? So we can start out by acting as if we are compassionate and that we love everybody. And then hopefully the acting will be brought inward and it will become heartfelt rather than just an act.
So theosophy is also, we're getting this connection lost. Are we coming in now?
No. It's,
oh, okay.
It's all right.
Okay, thank you. That has to do with the mouse. The wisdom religion is, the theosophy is also known as the wisdom religion. And it was once the religion of all mankind before we became more and more materialistic and separative, which is all a part of our evolution, the involution in the matter. But now we're trying to evolve past that. We pass the most materialistic, or the densest portion, the midway through this evolutionary period. And now
we have a chance.
The wisdom religion, it is, in its practical bearing, it is purely divine ethics based in metaphysics. And we have a chat, so let me read that. Practice makes perfect, and if we keep trying to be good, eventually we will be.
Yes.
Very good. SL, please.
True enough, but good and evil are relative. And what is good to one person in one culture, one time, is evil, or at least the lesser of two evils, for another. And even over the course of days and years, what we previously thought was good now doesn't seem to be. I mean, that's the whole point of the initial Bhagavad Gita. Coming face to face with things we previously thought were good and now recognize to be obstacles. So this chat, which is true in itself, can only be possible if through doing good, at least the way we see it at the time, we open ourselves up to wiser understanding of what needs to be done, a higher realization of what is good or true. That has to evolve along with our efforts.
So there's that idea of absolute truth. And absolute truth is true no matter what culture, no matter what time period. But to understand and recognize it and to put it into practice, that is the difficult piece of it.
Yeah, so there's many laws, and to try to keep people from acting in certain situations, but if we all were in tune with these teachings, well, we would never think about harming another or cheating someone out of what they're due. MDW?
Well, isn't that the very reason that these teachings have come forward again? in this century. It wasn't one of the main objectives of HPB to bring these teachings to the West, was to raise the ethical and moral consciousness of the humanity that we have come upon a dark age, and where spirituality is more or less cloaked in darkness, and that we have to look for it and search it out and want it to make that change. So it's the moral and ethical nature that she was trying to stimulate, not this law of an outside God that will punish you. And here's these laws that he has given you, and you must live by them. That it is from within us, our morality springs. And if we don't nurture that, it'll be locked away in our closet, in our heart, for many lifetimes.
Yes. Well, the modern expression of theosophy since the founding of the movement in 1875, it came at a time when religion had, at least one religious head had declared himself infallible in 1870. And really science they thought they were infallible too. They thought that they had reached the acme of knowledge. So we had materialistic religion and atheistic science in an age where materialism was becoming so onerous, it was becoming just soul crushing. And theosophy is balm for the soul. It's light, it's encouragement, and it's a guide. It's a guide to living that doesn't rely on the dictates of the scientist or priestcraft, who are telling us that we are body, resurrection of the body, not the soul, the body. You can lose your soul forever, but we're concerned about resurrecting the body. And yet these ideas are still very current and very accepted among a huge portion of humanity. And so, yes, MDW again.
Well, isn't that the main purpose of much of this, is to get us to think and consider our own nature, because we've all come from more or less the same place, the same atmosphere of education, and those of us that are here probably have questioned from a very early age the things that were going on that didn't seem like they were right, that can't be right, how we treat animals, how we treat each other.
Yeah, yes, that's one of the things that we all have. We realize when we know that something's not right, and we end up at theosophy. We realize we have been studying these ideas in the past, and fortunate enough to bring it forward into this life, and we have found a group of like-minded people to help broadcast these ideas. And one of the main ideas we know is looking at this idea of the sin of separateness, which permeates the world now in many, many, many cultures and religions and even science. So it behooves us to try and touch. It doesn't matter if we're discussing these ideas with huge crowds, just being compassionate, as was said earlier, to everyone we meet, being understanding, smile, you know, just helping somebody out that is stuck somewhere. So, you know, theosophy was brought to the West because we did need it. And we need to continue spreading these ideas out, and even just touching one person at a time, that person can touch another person, can touch another person. Did you want to say? JCS?
One religious thought leader, one masterful soul, taught about praying within the closet of one's heart. How would the theosophical teachings line up with praying within the heart, the closet of the heart? What would that mean in terms of the wisdom religion?
Well, if we look at the Lord's Prayer, or the Our Father, as some people call it, it talks about Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Well, that's our higher self. That's the God within. And it's actually a will prayer. It's, you know, lead us not into temptation. So we're asking to stay on the right path. But it's an invocation, and it's a realization of our divine nature, that we are in fact divine. Now, even though that is said in many churches every Sunday, we think they're taking a little different take on it, because it's that outside God that they're praying for to alleviate their suffering, because they don't have a knowledge of karma and its workings, which karma and reincarnation are the lost chords of many religions, really, not just Christianity, of other religions as well. And even in the East, it has, through Western influences, a lot of people have been swayed to Western modes of thinking. And they're more concerned with position, power, prestige, and material gain, unfortunately.
And with that will prayer, we believe it's that we're petitioning our higher nature. And we need to try and remain open to the promptings of the higher. So if we're praying, not even praying, but if we are petitioning our higher nature, we are trying to open up the lower to allow that higher to come through. And we have a chat.
So there's a couple chats in a row. The first is about keeping the perennial wisdom alive, even if it's done by just one individual. We should not keep this treasure hidden. We need to promulgate it. And that's our spread, broadcast the teachings. We agree. And it says, that's the beauty of theosophy. Every day we find out that every known fact we learned in our past has been written about in theosophy, and we all get our aha moment. So yes, a series of progressive awakenings, as it were. SL?
Sometimes in our application of the I doctrine, after a period of study, we really get enthusiastic about what we've learned in theosophy, and we try to share it with others, friends, family, and We meet up with unexpected resistance. And we wonder, how this is so wonderful, so true. How come everybody doesn't see this and benefit from it? And yet, we've observed with ourselves and also with other people in the world, a single act of kindness, pure kindness for another individual, witnessed by many, can be more elevating, more inspiring to help others and get them on to do the same thing than our attempts to spread true ideas. So why is that? Why is it that the application of the heart doctrine has more of an elevating effect on other people than our even our most sincere attempts to present a true idea intellectually to them?
Well, it's the heart quality, isn't it? It's that connection. It's that spark that can turn into a flame. That recognition of the divine and the other. But here's another thing. Sometimes we meet with unexpected acceptance of these ideas. As we had an example this week. Someone said, I read this theosophy. What is this? I was more confused than when I started. Can you tell me just in a few words what it is? And this person is a good, sincere, religious person. And after our conversation, we had much that we were in accord with. And we do not try to we don't try to say, no, we are right and you are wrong, because we would never get any, you know, if someone is a good, sincere person living a moral and ethical life and trying their best to live by the golden rule, they are a theosophist as well. They really are. We don't need to convert them. Now, they may not have be able to understand the I doctrine, as it were, but that doesn't mean that they don't really have it embodied within their nature. MDW?
Well, are we trying to convert anyone? Perhaps make them realize that they're a good human being as well. You know, that we, when we around our children or even our grandchildren, you know, how do we discipline them? Well, now that we're a generation removed, it's easier to be kind and loving when we discipline, rather than when our own children, sometimes we are very short-tempered and irritable. But now that we've grown wiser, we seem to approach it in a different way. So perhaps that's how we have to approach life.
Well, love conquers all, doesn't it?
Yes.
JCS.
And perhaps in those moments of vigor, when we've come from our own private studies and we're all aflame, or we're centered in this this intent to be spiritual and to share it, that's still a degree of self-centeredness, isn't it? So sometimes just resting in that space,
you're
going to
close
them. Yeah. And realizing that when the time is right, when the conditions are correct, the message will come through to all those we encounter because it's impressed within them as well. At some level, they're already there. may be theosophists unawares.
And that's the one of the things we can keep in mind, is that the way we act, the way we talk, the way we think, sometimes can make an impression on somebody else. And if we act differently in a situation that we would have from the past, then they want to know, why did you change? What is the difference here? That can always give us the opportunity to explain, maybe not in detail about theosophy, but in general, how it is that we came to these changes. And our time is up, and we want to thank all for attending, and hope to see you on Wednesday.
Bye all.
Bye all.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.